Hey there, Vermont Edition listeners. Hope you got a stack of pancakes because we have sugared off this episode until it's short and sweet. I'm Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. In a largely rural region like ours, most of us depend on cars to get around. A rough winter of ice, snow, and salt can cause intense wear and tear. Your Honda is hurting. Your Ford, freaking out. Your Chrysler, kicking the bucket. Your Lamborghini? Well, if you're driving a Lamborghini, you are fine. You do not need us today. Today on the show, we are diagnosing your car's ailments and offering winter maintenance tips and tricks. We are joined in the studio by Demony Pollitt, the owner and manager of Girlington Garage in South Burlington. Demony, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I should also note that Girlington Garage is a Vermont Public Business sponsor. And we are also joined by Steve Belitzos. He is a retired professor of Automotive and Transportation Services at Vermont State University's Randolph campus. Steve?
Hello, everybody. Also want to mention that Demony was one of my former students.
Yes, star student, right?
Indeed,
he was the best teacher I had.
Yep. Well, listeners, you can join our conversation this afternoon. It's not morning anymore. If you're worried about how your car is faring amid the ice and snow and road salt, you can give us a call at 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Demony, in this winter season, what is the most common issue that people are coming to your garage with?
I would say the most common unexpected issue would be batteries. Mm. Batteries, when it's cold out, the chemical reaction that happens in batteries that gives you power slows down a lot. So a battery that may not have been acting up when the weather was warm, as soon as it gets cold, it just doesn't have the power anymore to start the car. So people have to get their cars towed in for that.
Mm. And what do you do when that happens?
We test the battery, make sure that it is bad. Maybe sometimes it just needs a long charge or something like that. And if not, we just have to replace it. There's not a lot you can do with batteries.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're really corroded and you can clean them off and get a better connection on the terminals and that takes care of it. But it's pretty, usually you need to replace it.
Mm, okay, so corrosion is an issue we hear about a lot in the winter. Steve, what exactly causes a battery or another part of a car to corrode?
Oh, a chemical reaction between any two different metals would cause corrosion, especially at the battery terminals. You've got a lead-based battery terminal and another metal covering that lead-based terminal to get the power to the power distribution device. So that definitely causes corrosion. Mm. It's the green buildup you'll see around a battery on occasion.
Okay.
Yeah.
And salt, I'm guessing, doesn't help either.
It doesn't usually get to the battery.
Okay, but the other parts of the car can cause corrode.
So much damage.
Usually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What exactly does salt do to a car? What are Steve, maybe the most common things that you see?
It melts the metal is what it amounts to. Yeah, it causes oxidation of the metal parts, and that's what gives us the rust we have in so prevalent in our state and in New England, actually, anywhere in New England. Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that I think the state is using a slurry, a real liquid mix on the roads now, that doesn't help because it gets into every crevice and crack in a car and helps to promote corrosion.
Yeah, we posted about the show on Instagram today, on Vermont Public's Instagram. We got so many questions for you guys. One person asked, why is Vermont using a brine mix instead of, say, sand? It kills your car and road and creates icy conditions. Is that true? Is brine mix?
I think at a certain temperature it might, but I think the people at V-Trans have just figured that this is the best way to keep the roads as clear as they can. And they don't, as far as I know, V-Trans doesn't promote totally clear roads. They're not going to give us beautiful roads to ride on in a difficult time in the winter, but they're going to give us an adequate road so that we feel comfortable and safe.
Well, we got a lot of questions today about salt and the effect on cars and what to do to protect your car. Rick in Burlington asks, what is the best way to salt-proof a car? Demony, is that possible?
I don't think you can salt proof it, but you can do damage control. You can protect it as much as you can. There are various different undercoat chemicals that you can have put on your car. Some of them last longer than others, but most of them, they have to be reapplied every year and a half. Those are especially good if you get it done within, say, the first 3 years of the vehicle's life, and then maintain it throughout the life of the vehicle. It really, it makes a huge difference. And in Vermont, what kills a car is the rust. It's not your engine going or your transmission. It's rust eating away at the frame and the body of the car. You can also put it on already rusted vehicles. It will not stop the rust, but it will slow it down a little. So if your car isn't at the end of its life rust-wise, it may still be worth doing.
Mm. Is that the lanolin-based treatment you're talking about?
There is a lanolin-based treatment, and we have a mineral oil-based treatment that we use. Mm. Yeah, there's a couple different kinds out there. Mm.
If you have questions about how to protect your car from salt and from rusting out, you can give us a call at 800-639-2211. Rick in Burlington also asked if you all have ever heard of a Shaftesbury undercoat.
No.
It sounds like the beginning of a dirty joke.
That could be back to the old days when what people would do is get crankcase drainings, put them in a spray gun, spray the underside of the car and tell you to drive on a dirt road that would cause the sand and the dirt to cake and actually have some. But environmentally, it's not very friendly at all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Rick, that's what you're talking about. Call in.
Don't do that.
I mean, don't do it, but then also call in and tell us about it.
You know, if you keep your car as clean as possible, that helps too. On the way over, I saw a grosser Mercedes sedan, big sedan.
Yeah.
500 series that was beautifully clean. I mean, it looks like it just came out of the garage. It was so clean. And of course, that helps keep the salt off and helps prevent the rust.
Mm. I know that it takes 10 days for salt and water to turn into like hard rust on the frame of the vehicle. So if you, throughout the winter months, get your car washed, say, every 7 days, once a week, that will also make a big difference. Though, if you do have an undercoating on your car, do not go through a car wash that does the undercarriage wash. You'll wash it right off.
Oh, okay. Good to know. Yeah, we got a lot of questions about how often you should be washing your car in the winter. So, Demony, you're saying about seven days, once a week?
The more the better, but yeah, once a week is safe. Yeah.
Okay. And somebody also asked us on Instagram, is it ever too cold to go to the car wash?
I mean...
I guess if you feel sympathy for the people doing the car wash,
stuff
and don't want to see them be cold.
Doors will freeze. The rubber seals will freeze. There's a real risk of that happening.
Yeah, if you can get water in the locks.
Extremely cold.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which we've had recently.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, the cold weather, that is.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Never even knew to be worried about that when I went to the car wash. Okay, this is good. I'm learning a lot. So there's a difference between, you know, a car getting rusted and then a car getting rusted out, and you bring it in for an inspection, and somebody like you, Demony, says, that is unsafe to drive. Like, do not take this car anywhere. What is that line?
So it's unsafe when the components of the vehicle that protect you in an accident are no longer have their structural integrity. So the frame of the vehicle, when you get in an accident, that keeps the car from collapsing in on you in ways that it shouldn't. And the rust will actually eat through that really thick metal and create holes in it or cracks in it. It will also eat out parts of the body so that if you develop an exhaust leak, exhaust gases can get into the cabin of the vehicle. And there was a man who died, I think, in St. Albans, St. Johnsbury a couple of years ago because he got exhaust gases into the cabin of his vehicle.
Oh, wow.
So that can be very dangerous. So that's when it's not good to have your body rusting away.
Any other advice there, Steve, things to look out for?
Definitely so, especially the part about holes in the bodies to allow exhaust gases to get up, especially if you're sitting still for a long period of time. For instance, if you get stuck on the highway and you idle your car for a while, if you did have a hole in the body, then there's a chance that you could suffer carbon monoxide poisoning. Yeah. Oh, that's less of a danger than it was 40 years ago.
Mm. Why is that?
Emissions. Yep.
Emission standards.
Definitely so. It's really cut down the CO output of modern vehicles.
Yeah. Well, to address a Instagram follower's question directly, they're wondering how to keep their exhaust from rusting and whether or not deionizer spray will work. I see a shake of the head, Steve.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is either.
I try it.
It's not, you can't undercoat it either because the undercoat will just burn right off. Your exhaust system gets really, really hot.
Stainless steel exhaust would work if you wanted to spend the money to get a stainless steel exhaust system.
For longer. Eventually it will rust out.
Oh, yeah.
It'll last longer. But it's hard. I mean, you just sort of have to accept that your exhaust will only last, you know, 5-6 years.
Yeah. We also got a question from Laura wondering about recommended brands and types of undercoating. Demony, I think you mentioned one. Are there other ones?
Yeah, we use Corrosion Free. There is another one that people always call and ask if we carry, and I can never remember the name of it. I'm really sorry.
I don't know the names. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Maybe we'll look it up. We'll come back. It'll be a little teaser for this car show. If you have questions about keeping your car clean and safe this winter or tips for others, maybe you have an idea that you've learned over years and years of living in the winter, give us a call. The second I said we were going to take a break, Demony, that brand came to mind. What was it?
Fluid film.
Okay, great. Well, let's go to the phones. We have some callers calling in with some questions. Robert in White River Junction. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Great program so far. Here's one that just happened today to me. I have a Toyota Tacoma, and the battery light on the dashboard just came on. I've started and stopped the engine several times in the past hour. Should I be concerned?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
It came on because the charging system, for some reason, is not working. It could be a false positive, but it's best to get it checked out as soon as possible, especially this time of year.
Mm. Your car could stop working, possibly.
All right, Robert, get yourself to the garage. Good luck, and thank you for calling in. Anne in Wallingford is on the line. Anne, what is your question or your maybe a tip you have on car maintenance?
Okay, well, I was just going to share what I've done for rust prevention for decades and decades. So I've lived in Vermont for, I don't know, 50-some years and have had various cars. So what I've done, what I've been advised to do and I do, is you wash the car, go through the car wash, and make sure you get the undercarriage washed too. And you do this twice a year and then let it dry and let some dust build up underneath, and then you get it oil sprayed underneath, and the oil sticks to the whatever dust is still on there, which is good. You want a little grime there. So the oil goes through the grime and then to the metal, and then it stays there and it protects it. So you do it for the summer and the winter, and the reason for doing it in the summer is because many towns will salt their dirt roads to keep the dust down. So there's salt year-round. And anyway, that works. And you get oil sprayed with a used car, where I used to take it, he would use used motor oil. No, I guess it was new motor oil. And that worked fine. And then since I've had a new car, they said, take it to the wax oil place.
Okay, well, Anne, it sounds like this method is working well for you, but I will say you got a little bit of a grimace during that description from Steve. Steve, what made you react like that?
The oil tends to drop on the ground. That's the unfortunate part. So you're actually contributing to pollution. That kind of treatment is age old. It's been around forever, probably since the 30s or 40s even, and has worked very well because it's very effective. But unfortunately, you are dropping hydrocarbons under the ground, dropping oil on the ground, and you can't get away from that by using this particular type of treatment.
Mm. Well, thank you, Anne, for calling in. I'm glad it's working for you, but that's a helpful tip about being a little more environmentally friendly with our car maintenance when we can. Gene in Brattleboro is on the line. Gene, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
That last call reminded me that we used to use, I'm calling from Brattleboro, we used to use bar and chain oil for chainsaw oil to oil undercoat cars down here because it was stickier and stayed put better. But but between that and clean motor oil or transmission oil, that may even be illegal at this point because it's so hostile to the environment. And I guess some of these lanolin-based oils do the job and are, you know, less harmful to the environment, although they're also less friendly to sheep, I would imagine. But moving right along, here's a helpful household hint for 50 years of driving in Vermont to avoid doors and locks from freezing up.
Oh, yeah.
Either when you wash your car on a day that's too cold or you get one of these wonderful days where it pours and rains all day and then you get a flash freeze overnight. What you want to do is take a product like spray silicone, or I prefer using some other sprays, some other more environmentally friendly spray, and wipe down all the gaskets around the doors and the trunk lids a number of times if you have to. And for door locks, you spray a little Lockies in them, before it gets cold and rainy.
Gene,
and,
that seems like a good tip. I'm sorry to cut you off there. I just wanted to see if what
definitely
our guests
so.
Think.
Yeah, I think the silicone would work just fine. And I don't think you have to worry about any environmental concerns with that spray.
No,
not tremendous, not like oil.
Just using it around the gaskets.
Yeah.
It's
a good tactic.
Good advice.
All right, thanks, Gene.
Yep.
We have a call from Micah in Bristol. Micah, what's your question or comment?
Well, I just wanted to say hats off to Shaftesbury Undercoating and everybody who's doing undercoating of any oil variety out there. Big difference, as a lifelong Vermonter, big difference between any, paint as opposed to oil. The difference with hard paint, you guys might already talked about this, is this tendency to sort of trap rust. So you get it brushed up and looking better. You put paint on it, everybody feels great about it. Heck, I almost got ripped off on a Tacoma a couple of years ago when I went to buy one new because they had done just that. Mm-hmm. Well, that thing is probably rusted out by now. It was only a couple of years ago. But with oil, it breathes, and I use lanolin myself. But anyway, it's really great for, keeping the rust at bay. And, yeah.
You brought up the Shaftesbury undercoating, which someone mentioned in the first segment. For those who didn't hear it, you said that you're a big fan. What exactly is it?
Well, so it's just I take it that this is a local undercoating place. I might be misinformed.
Accurate. Okay, we thought it was a specific way of undercoating.
I think it's a colloquialism.
Oh, no, I didn't think so. But the materials I'm familiar with, in the old days they used bar oil and other kinds. They used motor oil, and then of course we have synthetic lanolin. Someone was kidding around about sheep before, but I believe it's synthesized in a lab.
All right. For some reason, I was really excited that the people of Shaftesbury had figured out some state secret about undercoating, but all right. all right, let's move on. Jessica writes, how do I keep my wiper line from freezing? When the roads get slushy, a film builds up on the windshield, making it incredibly difficult to see. Is there a specific winter fluid I can put in it? Please help. Jessica, I'm so glad you asked this. I was driving on 89 from Burlington to Montpelier last week to get to our live show we were doing at the State House, and I felt like I was driving completely blind. Demony, do you have any tips here?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the film she's talking about is, unless like it's a film of salt. When winter comes, you want to make sure that the washer fluid you're using is strong enough. So in the summer, you can dilute your washer fluid with water and get it to last longer. But in the winter, it will freeze right up if it's got alcohol in it. And so if it doesn't have enough alcohol in it, it'll just freeze right up. So you want to make sure that you're using full strength right from the bottle. I do know some people prefer Rain-X brand. That sort of leaves Steve has things to say about that. I'll let him talk more about it.
No, I absolutely love that stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't know we could mention product names.
Go for it.
But yeah.
We are not sponsored. Great stuff.
The other thing is you can make sure that the squirter nozzles are aimed in the proper place on the windshield.
Oh, okay.
Because if they're aimed too low or too high, they're not going to catch the area that your windshield wipers are wiping. So they won't clear the windshield.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I might need to try that because it's rough out there.
And they are adjustable. You can do a little ball in there that you can move around to change the direction, usually.
Mm. Yeah.
We got a lot of questions before today's show from listeners about snow tires. One question is, can you change your snow tires by yourself? And if you do want to do that, is there anything particular you should know? Demony?
Technically, you probably could. It would be a real struggle. Although, with the lower profile tires nowadays, I don't know if you actually could. We have machines designed specifically to take the tires off of the rim. That is the most difficult part of the job. And it's not something that you can just do with strength. It's taking a small circle off of a much larger circle. It's just really, really hard to do by yourself. So
it would be really difficult to do it without a tire machine. If you had two sets of rims, then you could put a winter set on one set and a summer set on the other set. But then you run the risk of the car falling down off the jack when you attempt to use it with a scissor jack.
Oof, not a way you want to go.
No. If you have if you have a floor jack and jack stands and you can support the vehicle while you do the job, then you're okay.
Yeah.
In your opinions, having driven in Vermont winters for many years now, is January, perhaps January 15th, too late for snow tires for all the procrastinators out there?
Never too late.
Yeah, never. Unless it's 2 days before it gets to be 70 degrees, it's never too late.
Yeah.
It's always better to have safer tires on, for sure. We've still got a good 2-3 months before we're out of snow season.
Yeah, we do.
I can remember being in a faculty assembly meeting right before graduation in May in Randolph Center, and we looked out the window and it was snowing like crazy outside.
Don't tell me that, Steve. No.
Guaranteed. This is Vermont.
We got an email from this from a listener named Andrew who says, unless you're going to wait till April, it's never too late to put on snow tires if you want to safely get anywhere. The only people who drive without snow tires in Vermont, in Andrew's opinion, are the unlucky visitors who got a rental car with summer tires, folks who can't afford to buy them. They are expensive. Or think they can get away with all seasons because they live in the city and just don't drive when there's a storm.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I think that's all true.
Yeah, definitely so.
Say somebody is trying to buy some snow tires secondhand, maybe off Front Porch Forum or Facebook Marketplace. Do you have any tips for what to look out for to make sure you're still getting a good set of reliable tires, Steve?
Tread depth. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure what the actual figure might be, but you definitely, one of the functions of snow tires is to kick the snow out of the tire. So if you've got a tire that's going to pack with snow, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So a trick you can do is if you take a quarter and you stand it on its head, so George Washington is standing on his head, and you stick it between the treads, if you can see the top of his head, the tire is no longer safe to use in the winter.
Mm.
That doesn't tell you if there's enough tread. It tells you when there's not enough tread, essentially. The other thing you want to look for is cracking. Over time, you know how when rubber bands get old, they break a lot easily, a lot more easily? Tires do exactly the same thing. And you can see the cracking on the tires between the treads on the sidewall. And it will often just be very, very minuscule cracks that are hard to see, so you have to look closely. But if you see any cracking in the rubber, those tires are too old. It's not worth investing money into. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to the parts store, you can get a tire tread depth gauge for maybe $5. And I would say you don't want to if you get a tire with maybe 6/32 on it, that'll be good for a good season, one season for sure, maybe two seasons. That's sort of the end of its life. So you want more than 6/32 on a set of snow tires.
Okay. Good tips. Krista in Guilford is calling in. Krista, what's your question or your comment?
My question is this. I got my snow tires on in December and then headed home to Baltimore for a family trip. And while we were driving, we heard this awful sound. We ended up pulling over in, Connecticut and found some auto body shop that was open, and they said I had several lug nuts that were loose. One had broken off, and one was missing. And I was wondering, do lug nuts need to be tightened after you get your snow tires on and before you go on a long trip?
Yeah, it's not a bad idea to have someone check your lug nuts. When a tech puts a tire back on, they should tighten it in a star pattern so that it tightens evenly. But even so, with the flexing of the metal, a lug nut can, you can think it's tightened, and as the wheel settles into place, it can become a bit looser. So it's not a bad idea when you have tire work done to go back, have them check the torque the lug nuts.
And you can actually use your own lug wrench to do that, to make sure they're tight.
Yeah.
Because in a situation like that, I'm sure that somebody left them loose and that was the end result.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Krista, for calling in, and good luck. Megan via email says that AAA told them that their car battery froze while they were away for a couple weeks over the Christmas break. They ask, how can I leave my car during the winter months without ruining my battery? AAA suggested I leave a charger plugged into the battery while I was gone. Is that appropriate? What do you all think?
Yeah, you can do that.
A battery minder, a very low-level trickle charger would do the trick.
Yeah.
You can always take it out.
What is that?
Or disconnect it.
A trickle charger?
Yeah. Is it exactly what it sounds like?
It just trickles energy into the battery. Yeah. The battery is going to, unless you've got a switch that cuts off the electronics completely for a short time while you're not driving the car, then parasitic loads are going to cause the battery to drain down over time.
What are?
Parasitic loads.
Ooh,
just what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yikes.
Parasites in your car that are slowly sucking power out of it, the key is turned off.
That's something I have to worry about too?
Especially in older cars.
With all the computing power on cars these days, they do use a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And usually they don't come totally alive unless you put the key in, but sometimes they will stay, especially on older vehicles.
Mm. Well, from older vehicles, let's transition to newer ones, particularly EVs, electric vehicles. Demony, what's it been like working on what I assume is a greater and greater percentage of EVs? Is that the case?
Yeah, we're getting more and more EVs. It's a whole different beast.
Yeah.
And it's even a different thing from simply hybrid vehicles. I have a technician that I've sent away to school to specialize specifically in EVs because it is so different. They're definitely not the majority of the cars we work on yet, but more and more people are buying them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that people often take their car directly to the dealer if it's an EV versus going to a garage? Or are more folks getting specialized in this work, like you're saying, with your employee?
I mean, a lot of them are still new enough that they're under warranty, so that for the more complicated work, they're going to dealerships. But, people will bring EVs to us for maintenance, for tire changes, for basic stuff like that. And we do get some that really don't like the dealer, and so they ask us to do the more difficult diagnostic work. Or there are EVs out there that are getting old enough, they're no longer under warranty, and there's no reason for them to go to the dealership.
One of the tough parts about an EV is that it can lose battery a lot quicker in the winter and the cold weather. Is that something that people come to you talking about or asking for tips on? Anything you've picked up in that
area? EV battery specifically?
Yeah, specifically.
Not that I can think of, not especially. We have had a few EVs that have battery problems, but not specifically because of the cold weather. I believe that they're the same as any other battery, so they're going to they're going to struggle more in cold weather. They're going to work less efficiently. But we haven't had vehicles that are having that specific problem.
Yeah. It seems like a whole new world of auto maintenance.
Absolutely
right here.
Is.
Steve, was this something that was a part of your work when you were a professor, or did the EV wave kind of come after your retirement?
Yeah, I broke just about the time that I actually retired. I took some courses in EV and especially hybrid stuff. But most of it came in after. So I I defer to Demony. I'm not really feel comfortable in talking that much about EV maintenance stuff because I never saw that much EV maintenance at the time when I was on the floor.
Mm, yeah. Well, a lot of folks buy electric vehicles because of environmental concerns about the use of gas. And we got a number of emails and messages today with people have other types of environmental-related concerns around cars. For example, William in East Montpelier writes, I am not a fan of warming up a car before driving. Is it recommended, and why? Is there harm besides the obvious environmental issues? Steve?
Well, first of all, when a car is cold, then that's the time when it's going to suffer its maximum damage because it has the most... the largest amount of clearance within the engine. Mm. And also, if it's sitting there idling, it's not working very hard. So if you take it out on the road and start working it right away, then that's going to help it warm up more quickly.
Mm. Any thoughts there, Demony?
Yeah, cars are not designed... I think cars... Back in the 90s and before, you really did want to let your car warm up before you started driving them. But they are not designed for that anymore. They are designed to start driving right away. It's better for your gas mileage. It's better for emissions. And like Steve said, driving them helps them warm up faster, so there's less damage.
Okay. A lot of cars have two thermostats these days, too, to retain more more coolant in the engine so it warms up quicker. Mm. My Hyundai is very rapid. It's a 2020, so it's 5 years old now.
Mm. Well, speaking of heating your car, one person on Instagram asks, does using heat in my car use up the oil faster? Should I check the oil more often in the winter? Are those connected at all?
No.
No?
Nope.
All right, Instagram friend, you're good to go. And then last, we do have to wrap up in just a moment, but I'm curious, Demony, last time you were on the show was about a little over a year ago. What's business like so far? Like, what's changed in the last year for you all
in
at Girlington?
Last year, maybe more electric cars, but I don't think that much has changed. We are just as busy as we ever were. Yeah. I can't say a lot. That's
good.
Not.
Things are good.
I don't have a good, interesting answer.
No, that's great. I feel like no news is good news.
Exactly.
And Steve, I know you're retired. Are you still working on cars in your off time?
Only
my
own.
Yeah.
Just yeah. But to piggyback on what Demony said, I think if a service provider offers a good service at a reasonable price, that's effective, then they'll do very well, which is what Demony has done.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. It's all about being honest and doing a good job. Yeah. And hiring good techs and all that stuff.
Is it hard to find techs to hire? Are there a lot of trained folks out there?
No. There's a real shortage of technicians right now.
Across the entire industry. Heavy-duty trucks, cars, you name it.
It's really difficult. People are not going into the field, and the technicians that are in it are retiring out of it. So, and it's been a good 10, 15 years that people have not been going into the field. So we're suffering a real shortage.
Why do you think that is?
I think partly because guidance counselors and schools have not been encouraging kids to go into the trades. And it's not just automotive. It's all the trades. They're all really suffering and struggling. And then with automotive technology, there's a huge investment that you have to make in your own tools. There are also no paid apprenticeships the way there are with other trades. So it's a much bigger investment for people to go into that. So perhaps that's also scaring people away.
Mm. Well, Steve, do you have any final words for somebody who might be listening and is saying, you know, hey, it sounds like there is a job out here for me?
There's definitely a job out here if you want to want to put the time into getting the education and also buying the tooling. But saying that, I would recommend that people look at the heavy-duty side of the industry for two reasons. First of all, it's not you don't get paid by flat rate. In other words, the amount of time that a book tells you to do the job. Hope I don't step on any toes. Heavy-duty techs are paid hourly. They want the job to be done right the first time. It's a commercial vehicle. It's going to go out on the road. And they don't want any difficulties. Flat rate tends to maximize a person who is fast, maybe take some cuts, some quarters that they're experienced with. I don't like the system. And that may be a personal thing. But, yeah, if you want to make money, go to the heavy-duty side. And I think that I was born to be a technician. I started out.
Yeah.
my working career in social work and went from there to auto technology. And
that's a big shift.
I never looked back. I loved it.
That's what I did too.
Yeah.
Really?
It's a lifelong learning experience. Engineers are out there dreaming up all kinds of crazy stuff that they want us, that they want cars to do these days.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you two found this passion that you both love and that you could teach us about it today. Demony Paulett of Girlington Garage and Steve Belitzos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. It was really fun.
One of Vermont's former governors, Tom Salmon, died yesterday at the age of 92. Democrat from Rockingham in Windham County. He was a lawyer and a judge. He was then elected to the state legislature. He was the House Minority Leader back when Democrats were the minority. He then served two terms as Vermont's governor in the 1970s. And later in his career, he was the president of the University of Vermont. Joining us now to help remember former Governor Tom Salmon is another former Democratic governor, Peter Shumlin. He was in office from 2011 to 2017. Governor Shumlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure to be with you.
One key part of Governor Salmon's career that many folks listening might remember is this big upset in 1972 when he won his first gubernatorial term. What do you remember about that time?
Well, I was a high school kid, and no one expected Tom Salmon to become governor of the state of Vermont. He was running against Fred Hackett. Fred was a very established insurance and business person in Chittenden County. Here was a young guy from Windham County. We don't elect governors from Windham County, let's not forget, or very infrequently.
That's not a law, is it?
People down. Yeah, we don't. Well, it's not a law. We just have no people down here compared to Chittenden. And that was true then, and it's true now. So, you know, it was a huge upset. Yeah. And frankly, it was sort of the beginning of folks transitioning to understanding that we have to protect Vermont, we have to protect our environment, we have to have property taxes that are reflected in one's income, not just one's property value. It was really the beginning of what we've all come to accept as usual.
Yeah. And he was also running when at the same time that President Richard Nixon was running for re-election. We have a clip of Governor Salmon reflecting on that campaign. This is from a 1989 interview with Vermont Educational Television, which was a precursor to Vermont Public.
To win the campaign against considerable odds, we had to do a number of things right. And since Vermont was then, is now, such an issue-oriented state, we had to identify, without the benefit of any money to run polls, what people in Vermont cared about. And we came to the conclusion that they deeply cared about their environment, the quality of life in this state, on the one hand, and were becoming alarmed, as the press accounts indicated, with significant money being poured into real estate investment in the state. The other issue was the old chestnut of average people in the state becoming deeply concerned about the level of the property taxes they paid as it affected them. We sensed those were the issues, and we, through some very creative talent and brainstorming by some very bright people, came up with programs that directly related to both of those concerns.
Peter Shumlin, hearing Governor Tom Salmon talking about property taxes there, I mean, history really repeats itself, huh?
It sure does. Brings tears to my eyes. I actually took time off from college to work for Governor Salmon's unsuccessful bid for the U.S. Senate. But what they did in that gubernatorial campaign, you know, remember, pre-internet, pre-technology, they printed up little cards of Vermont trees and the Green Mountains, and they would pass these out everywhere they would go, bars, fairs, door to door, you name it. And it simply said something like, my memory remembers it saying something like, Vermont is not for sale. And then he promised in the process to link, it became the property tax rebate program, by the way, which we had before Act 60, but to link for folks who had a house and 2 acres, you know, property value to income instead of property assessment. In other words, give Vermonters a break. Mm. And that was back when Vermont was being developed with great exuberance. Republicans in Vermont were still saying, why why preserve the environment? Are we just saving it for the wild animals? You know, I mean, it was the beginning of the discussions that we now have today with great exuberance. Mm.
Well, speaking of Republicans, I spoke on the phone this morning to former Governor Jim Douglas, a Republican, and he was telling me about how he served his first year in the Vermont legislature during Salmon's first gubernatorial term. And Douglas said that he remembers that 1972 election, as we've discussed, is a big surprise. And after this fractious Republican primary, a lot of Republicans who had supported Jim Jeffords stayed home or voted for Tom Salmon, a Democrat. And Douglas, this really stuck out to me. He said that he really, you know, he remembers Tom Salmon very fondly, even though they didn't agree on everything. Like Salmon wanted to raise the sales tax, but Douglas and other Republicans did not. And he also said that the 70s to him were a really collegial time in state government. And when we said goodbye, he said, thanks for honoring my buddy today. So Peter Shumlin, I'm curious what you think about those comments from Jim Douglas about that time in the 70s, perhaps feeling a bit more collegial, or there was some evidence of good cross-party collaboration.
Well, Governor Douglas is right about that. I would also point out, though, that let's not forget how things have shifted politically.
Yeah.
Governor Tom Salmon today could never win a Democratic primary. He could probably never get elected governor of Vermont in the respect that he wouldn't get through the Democratic primary. In other words, he was what we would call today a blue dog Democrat. You know, he believed, he was passionate, he was charismatic, he was a great speaker. The things that he was fighting for in 1972 were radical then for Democrats. But if you look how the pendulum has shifted in all politics, where frankly, Republicans, you know, frankly, Luther Hackett, who he beat, would have been considered today a very moderate, probably very moderate Democrat. In other words, everything has shifted in both parties. Hmm. The right of the Republican Party, MAGA, has probably very little in common with most Republicans in Vermont, including our governor, Phil Scott. You look at the Democratic side, and so the progressive Democrats would not have accepted a Governor Thomas P. Salmon. So, you know, it's a different world. Mm.
We have Alex calling in from Brattleboro. Alex, do you have a memory of former Governor Tom Salmon to share?
Well, I was a little too young to be there directly with the governor, but I have an anecdote about my mother having some puppies to give away at the state fair and seeing the governor come up, and she said, "Will the governor kiss my baby?" And the governor was very, very obliging and gave the dog a peck on the head. So he was a good sport about it.
Oh, thank you for sharing that with us, Alex. Former Governor Peter Shumlin, could you help us remember Tom Salmon, not just as a politician, but as a person and a community member?
You know, Tom Salmon would have been sort of, in my view, Vermont's John Kennedy. He was charismatic. He loved to have fun. I can remember him as governor, you know, seeing him on TV dancing at rock parties at various governor's things. He loved life. He loved people. He liked to work hard and play hard. And he loved his kids and his family. But most importantly, I think Tom Salmon came from nothing. And he came to Vermont with literally not enough money to get a hotel room after he finished law school. He wasn't from a family of privilege. He never forgot where he came from. He always fought for the folks that he grew up with, which were those that get skipped over by government usually. And, you know, the extraordinary thing about him was he was always absolutely fun, brilliant, and ready for a good time. Loved his sports teams, loved being in Bells Falls, small town, Rockingham, that he considered home. And he was a form of political leader that got elected because of his charisma as much as what he stood for.
Mm. Yes, he was raised.
So, yeah, he would kiss a puppy any day of the week and laugh all the way.
I was going to add that he was raised in Massachusetts and moved to Vermont in the late 50s to open a law firm. And there was a bit from his gubernatorial farewell address that stuck out to me. He said, "I came to this state in 1958 with barely enough money in my pocket to pay for an overnight room. In 14 short years, I became governor." Pretty remarkable. Let's squeeze in one more caller here. We have Judy in South Burlington on the line. Judy, what are your memories of Governor Tom Salmon?
Hi, I'm Judy Rosenstrike. I was elected in 1972 to the House of Representatives from Waterbury. I was 28 years old, so it made history as I was the youngest woman ever elected to the General Assembly in its history. I served for 4 years with Governor Salmon, and I know that he was very interested in making transportation a cabinet-level agency, and I sponsored the legislation that created V-Trans. So I'm proud of that. I have a lot of memories. He was a good governor, and he really had problems that he didn't really expect. Like, there was no snow during 2 winters in a row. And you can imagine how that affected the Vermont economy. You know, right now we don't have as much snow as we did in the old days, I'll call it. But at that time, no snow, snowless winters was a thing of the past, and it was very problematic.
Oh, yes, probably very worrisome for Vermont's winter-based economy. And Judy, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that behind-the-scenes look of your time in the legislature while Governor Tom Salmon was governor.
Judy was an amazing legislator, by the way, and did great things for Vermont. I'm glad to hear her voice.
Oh.
But that was the era of people working together in a bipartisan fashion to get done what Vermont needed, you know, and that's what Tom Salmon helped to lead.
Mm. Lastly, Peter Shumlin, what is one piece of Tom Salmon's legacy or something that you learned from him that you like to carry on with you as we move into the future?
I think the most important legacy for Governor Salmon that I never forgot was two things. The first was, if you don't feel in your heart moved by issues, don't be in public service. Tom Salmon didn't run for governor because he wanted to be a great man. He ran for governor because he saw things that he thought could be fixed, could be better, could be made to work, and he wanted to fix them. And I think the second part is, I think that much of our legacy, his legacy in Vermont, was to begin to make politically acceptable the notion that the environment was the foundation of Vermont, that was our success, that was our economic base, that if we messed that one up, we messed everything up. And, you know, Judy just referred to snowless winters being a problem for him. That was a big deal back in the 70s. Now we have snowless winters all the time. But, you know, this was pre-climate change, pre the awareness that what we were doing to the planet was going to destroy it. He got that. And he was an early leader in ensuring that we as Vermonters left this state better than we found it, or try to at least.
Governor Peter Shumlin, thank you so much for helping us remember former Governor Tom Salmon today.
Well, thank you. We'll miss him. He had a great life, a long life, and he did great things for Vermont. That's all we can ask of our citizens.
Mm, indeed. If you have a memory of former Governor Tom Salmon you'd like to share with us and didn't get a chance during this segment, you can always email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. That is all the time that we have for today. Our show is directed by Aaliyah Papes. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, who was also our call screener today. And our show is produced by Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Our intern is Anna Berg, and our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.